welcome back to another episode of Gladio for Europe. I am your host for this evening, Liam, and I'm here with Russian Sam.
Hello.
And we're also joined by a very special guest that a couple of you real old heads might remember from a pilot episode, and that is a very good friend of ours, Jamie.
Hello, everyone. Glad to be back with the crew.
So we have been planning this episode for a while. It's something that is pretty close to my heart, this movie. It's a really interesting work of art and a really cool historical artifact that is a great insight into a particular moment in world history. The movie is Soy Cuba, also known as I Am Cuba or Ya Cuba, from 1964, a Soviet epic drama filmed in Cuba, basically charting the course of the Cuban Revolution through these different stories of everyday Cuban people. It's a really cool movie, and it's also really interesting in the way that it shows this Russian view of Cuba. So, Jamie, you are a great friend. You're a super smart guy. You've got really good thoughts on movies, and you also happen to be from Cuba. So we thought it would be amazing if you could come in here and tell us basically what you thought about this movie.
Oh, thank you for the very generous introduction. I appreciate that. So, I mean, just from the get-go, I did enjoy this movie quite a lot. It's something that shocked me, that was able to capture some things about Cuba that I did not think were able to be captured in 1964. A lot of themes and scenes of what pre-revolution Cuba was like, something that I've studied and read in notebooks and heard from family members, I still found in the movie. And I was like, oh, wow, even in 1964, given, you know, it was still fresh enough, but a lot of this still holds up to what I know what Cuba was like pre-1959. So, yeah, the story is not something, you know, crazy, but the way the movie was shot, the different environments that they showcase, the different struggles, was something that I was able to look at each of them and be like, oh yeah, that's something I've definitely heard about pre-1959 Cuba. So enjoyed it quite a lot.
And, you know, of course, we don't only have a Cuban person here today. We, of course, also have a good friend from the Russian diaspora. As a Sam and as a person of Russian origin, if you have any thoughts on this movie or as a fan of cinema that you want to share, please do.
I definitely enjoyed this movie quite a bit. I actually came upon it when I was still in high school, so it was a very early experience for me. That's around the time when I really started to begin to love Soviet film. And this movie is one of the all-time greats, not necessarily because the plot is great, because let's face it, it's kind of a very basic plot, but it's just such an innovative film in terms of the things that they actually shot this with and the different techniques. And it's just a very stunning film. Like this is what you get a projector for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why one nice happy ending of this story that we're about to get into is that it now is recognized as this really incredible work of cinema. And there's no other way to describe it. This is a movie that everybody, especially if you have an interest in film, should see. We've watched a lot of pretty bad movies on this podcast. This is not one of them. This is one that as soon as you finish listening to this episode, please, if you have not seen Soy Cuba, find it out. Now, just to get into what this episode's going to be, we're not really going to go too far into the plot of the movie or what exactly happens. I also don't want to give away too many spoilers, you know, about the story, if that's something that you're worried about.
So, spoiler alert, the Cuban Revolution happened.
Wow, that's first true, time yes. I've heard of that.
yeah, but so what I really want to talk about here is the context in which this movie was made. Not just the context of, you know, the Cuban Revolution, but really the context of the Soviet film industry. Why was there such a demand among Russian filmmakers to look at Cuba? And what impact did this movie have on kind of, you know, the history of the Cuban image of Russia and the Russian image of Cuba? And I also wanted to say, just before we get started here, thank you so much, Russian Sam, for the incredible translation work you've done for this episode to work.
Well, I'll do anything for our three fans.
Yeah, we love dearly.
All right. These three fans have waited enough. Let's get started. So this story, I would say, the story of Soy Cuba does not begin on the island of Cuba. I think it begins in Russia. And I think it begins not in 1964, when this film was released in theaters. I think this story begins in 1945, with the end of World War II, this cataclysmic conflict, truly of biblical scale, for the Soviet Union that wrought horrors and torment onto the Soviet people that really nobody not involved can really understand. The conflict was so devastating that the relief effort in the Soviet Union was massive. And of course, unlike in Western Europe, which didn't even suffer close to these level of casualties, they didn't have anything similar to the Marshall Plan. There was this massive need for a buildup. Resources had to be distributed from other areas. One of the areas that suffered from this very necessary reconstruction effort was film. Many filmmakers in the Soviet Union were involved in the war effort during World War II. When the war ended and the military was drawn down, a lot of these filmmakers who had been making wartime propaganda were out of work. And we looked up the official Soviet film catalog, and it's somewhat striking to see films increasingly dwindle in the years after World War II, which also happened to be the last years of the Stalin government. Notoriously, in 1951, only 9 films were produced in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, but for the record, I'm still not convinced that there were only 9 films. I just think that that list is incomplete because I can't fathom it.
In any case, many Soviet filmmakers felt that they were left out in the cold in the years after World War II. There had been a thriving film industry before World War II, especially in the 1920s, before Stalin really consolidated power, and there was this flowering of experimental filmmaking in the early Soviet Union, but it had slowed down, and many filmmakers were really disappointed. The films that did tend to be made in this time were very conventional artistically and in terms of story. Probably the most famous Soviet film from the post-war period is The Fall of Berlin. It's basically as typical of Soviet Stalinist propaganda as you can imagine, and kind of infamously, it ends with Stalin arriving in Berlin, which of course never happened. He never visited Berlin. And he arrives in Berlin to cheering crowds of Berliners.
And then everybody clapped, literally.
Yes, it really is, yeah. And of course, you know, anyone who knows much about the Soviet occupation of Berlin knows that, tragically, it did not end like that. Berliners were not exactly having a good time when the Red Army got there. Basically, just this shows what was happening there. And a lot of Soviet filmmakers really started to resent this situation. As filmmaking slowed down, you also saw increasing amounts of foreign films brought in. This is how the long Russian flirtation with Bollywood began, because it was cheaper to import Indian films than make Russian films. In addition, one thing that really offended a lot of filmmakers was that Nazi films, German films that had been seized during the war, were now being screened in the Soviet Union. So let me just pause here and try to imagine you are a Soviet filmmaker. You're somebody who was a very a passionate Marxist in the teens, in the 20s. You were part of the first generation of Soviet filmmakers. You go through this unbearable conflict during World War II, and you want to keep making films. You want to spread the socialist message, but you can't. You have to sit down, you have to get a job in some other field, and now you see that your neighborhood cinema is showing some Nazi musical.
Well, you know, the Soviets are a very environmentally minded bunch. We got to use every part of the Nazi.
But then, of course, something big happened that started to change this in 1953.
Stalin died.
Yes, the death of Joseph Stalin. Khrushchev immediately comes in, very different kind of figure, very different form of government, and he starts the Khrushchev thaw. It was this broad opening up of different aspects of society, sort of a restriction on the control over so many aspects of life that was associated with the Stalin government, and it led to this really incredible flowering of creative filmmaking that was pretty similar to what happened in the 1920s. You saw the first film schools opening up in the Soviet Union, mostly led by a man named Mikhail Rom, who had been an experimental filmmaker back in the 20s. You saw influences coming in from America, from Italy, and France. And all these new young filmmakers were involved in this system. Andrei Tarkovsky, maybe the most famous Soviet filmmaker of the second half of the 20th century, came out of this period. And in addition, what really brings in the story of Soy Kuba is that many older filmmakers, including filmmakers who had not gotten as much work in the Stalinist artistic drought of the last years after World War II, they were brought back out of retirement, and they started making movies again. One of these older filmmakers who did get a little bit of work done in the Stalin era was Mikhail Kolotozov. Kolotozov had gotten his start in the 20s, in that really experimental period. And here's Mikhail Rom, the founder of the Soviet Film Academies, describing what it was like in the 20s. But this is, again, 40 years before Soy Kuba, what that environment was like.
The atmosphere was very confused, very colorful. And in the midst of all that, the pioneers of Soviet cinema led their revolutionary column. Directors of that era fought for a revolutionary art and a progressive art, and all under extremely difficult conditions.
This shows that this was part of their vision of the socialist future. These filmmakers were very, you know, they were ardent Marxists, and they really thought that they were part of a global revolutionary project that they earnestly believed would emancipate the world through their art.
When we were young, the cinema was not yet an art. It was a curious and not very respectable branch of activity. Most of us came to the cinema by chance, and most often by way of traditional arts like theater. We suffered failures as actors, sculptors, or painters, and we looked for a way out in the cinema. Hundreds of failures of all kinds were thrown into it at any given time. It was not difficult to become an assistant, even a director in Moscow or Leningrad. In Ukraine and Georgia, it was even easier.
You know, one of these guys from Georgia was Kolotozov, the Soy Kuba director, who he happened to be Georgian, and he got started in this experimental cohort. Some other big names that a few of you guys might know, Jiga Vertov was this incredible pioneer of editing and cinematography, as well as Lev Kuleshov, who, you know, created this famous editing technique known as the Kuleshov effect today. But then by the early 30s, when the Stalinist policy started kind of wrapping down, the experimental period ended. Kolotozov managed to avoid being suppressed in this time, and like I said before, he also kept working during the drought of the early 50s. And so I think this is kind of important, because it was kind of a Nixon goes to China thing. This is a guy who's been a filmmaker for a very long time, Kolotozov. He was able to keep making films at the height of the purges in the mid-30s, and he was also able to make films after World War II, when there was so little money available to produce movies. So what this means is that because he was someone that they trusted, this old filmmaker who happened to have a more experimental background in his youth, he was now able to produce the kind of stuff in the mid-50s, when Khrushchev came in, that was almost as experimental as the stuff he had made in the 20s. He even published an open letter in the official Soviet film magazine that actually condemned the state of the film industry before the Khrushchev thaw and demanded new changes to the industry.
Yeah, so in his letter, Kolotozov insisted that, first of all, film should be allowed to be difficult. A movie need not be crowd-pleasing as long as it is thought-provoking. Two, film ought to be allowed to shock the audience if it is necessary for artistic intent. And third, film should offer social critiques that can advance the worldwide socialist project, even if it means criticizing existing socialist governments.
And an example of film that does that kind of criticism is The Cranes Are Flying. Have any of you seen that, either you two?
I did not know about it, but in my, you know, research of this movie and the director, I heard that was like one of his bigger films that really took off. So
it's a World War II movie that doesn't have any of the glory of earlier pictures like The Fall of Berlin, and it's very critical of the behavior of a lot of Soviet officials during this period. And it really tells the story of a corrupt officer whose brother is out. While his brother is out fighting and dying in the mud, he seduces and marries his brother's girlfriend. Beyond the story, it's just incredibly well shot, and it has really interesting direction. And this earned the Palme d'Or at Cannes, which is the most celebrated film prize in the world. This also led to this sudden global interest in Soviet filmmaking. It was really a kind of a high point of the prestige of Soviet film. So this was a time that was amazing for filmmakers in the Soviet Union by the late 50s, early 60s, the Khrushchev thaw, but it wasn't great for everyone. A lot of more hardline Marxists are incredibly critical of the economic reforms of the Khrushchev period that gave more power to local decision makers and took away power from the kind of central economic planning committees, and some people argue sort of paved the way for the opening toward capitalism that happened over time. In addition, by the 60s, the economic progress and growth of the early Khrushchev period had begun to slow down. There was this kind of the notorious stagnation of the Soviet Union in the later stretch of the Soviet history began now. And also, there were a lot of pretty controversial actions by the Khrushchev government. You know, infamously in 1956, a major Hungarian protest was violently suppressed. And then in 1962, with a little more levity here, Khrushchev had this infamous encounter at a modern art gallery, where he was really kind of horrified with the creative lengths that some of the artists of the thaw that he had initially supported had been taking.
For the first time, Khrushchev's gaze lingered upon the portrait of a girl. What is this? Why is one eye missing? It's some kind of morphine addict. His voice grew more and more shrill with each word. Khrushchev, surrounded by a dense crowd, rushed around the walls. Over and over again, his shouts of shit, crap, and smudge were heard. The premier's voice was joined by grimacing sobs. That's right. It's hideous. Send them all far away from here. Khrushchev became livid. Who gave them permission to paint like that? Let them all go to the lumber yards and let them work off the money that the state has spent on them.
Oh my god.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, so what this shows is that, you know, one way to frame the kind of the early 60s, you know, was that the Soviet Union, you could argue, was started beginning to look a little bit like the U.S., there is a sort of crisis of conscience, which I think speaks to a broader lack of faith in the Eastern European socialist project. You had a lot of dissatisfied people on every side. Some people who thought that the Khrushchev reforms went too far. Some people who thought that the reforms didn't go far enough. And I think it's fair to say that by the mid-60s, a malaise had set in. A malaise where there were people who were maybe questioning their faith in the whole socialist ideal in general. And then something happened. New Year's Day, 1959. What happens?
Oh, you know, very nice guy with a really good beard and bunch of paisanos and guajiros. They ride into town, several towns across the island, and proclaim the end of an era and the start of a new one. An inclusive one at that, you know. Fidel Castro and his guerrilla fighters have taken over the island of Cuba. And so proclaim the new government. And this is the start of a lot of things, that's for sure.
And what's crazy is that the Soviet government, you know, they had no idea this was going to happen. This was completely autonomous. It wasn't, as the Americans portrayed it, a decision from Moscow, you know.
Right.
In truth, Moscow was often the one that was left out in the dark, dragging its own feet because they were so cautious in their foreign policy and just actively refused to help communists in many parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that I find very ironic here is that as soon as the day that the revolution happened, when there's reports of Khrushchev and his fellas, you know, talking about it, and they had decided, oh, this guy Fidel, probably a CIA agent, probably just, you know, the CIA replacing one of their puppets with another one.
That was the on par for Cuba, you know, from the very beginning, just one after the other.
Mm-hmm. And we should point out that, you know, they did not have close ties with Moscow at the beginning, and they even, Fidel and Raul, tried to extend an olive branch to Washington, but they were rejected.
Yep, they were.
And because of this unbelievable bag fumble by the Kennedy administration, and initially the Eisenhower administration, you saw this deliberate pivot that the Castro government made toward Moscow. In addition, you had the start of these socialist policies in Cuba. You had the land reform. You had these major efforts to reduce the unbelievable inequality and poverty in Cuba, especially felt by rural Cubans, and especially felt by Afro-Cubans. And then in 1961, you had Washington make maybe their biggest mistake yet, the Bay of Pigs.
Oh man, the Bay of Pigs invasion. You know, being a Miami Cuban, I can't tell you how many times I've heard about the Bay of Pigs from some old head. Oh, that damn Kennedy, he screwed us. If it wasn't for him and we had a good Republican, we would have taken Cuba. It would have been the new state. It would have been great. Fidel would have been dead and this and that. It's just a story that goes in loops and loops. And, you know, it's hard to find a Miami Cuban that'll give you a nice objective spiel on things. It's just everything is, you know, a little bit of bias.
Would you say that an objective take on it is that it was a failed invasion that was backed by the U.S., but was sort of half-assed, and so as soon as these U.S.-backed rebels got there, they were swamped by the Cuban military and arrested?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was just a poorly planned invasion. You know, you just had these wealthy Cubans who had just left Cuba resettle in Miami. And so these Cubans had great access to power and money in America. So they just thought, you know, we're going to take back our land and our island. And you had U.S. corporate interests on the island. So it was just a, you know, mostly agreed takeover of the island is what they were looking for.
Basically, as a response to the Bay of Pigs, what did the Cuban government do?
Announce their support for the Soviet Union.
Fidel, I believe it is also when they officially announced that they were going to be a socialist republic. They announced support for Marxism.
Yeah, at the beginning, you know, there's something popular that I did not know about until I took a course on the history of Cuba, is that the first 2 years of the revolution is what they call the revolution was still green. It was still a peasant revolution, a rise against power. It was something for the Cuban people, you know, to just uplift them out of these horrible conditions that they were under. And then it wasn't until 61 when the revolution turned red, with the proclamation of a socialist republic and the alignment with the Soviet Union. You know, at the beginning, you had middle class white people in Havana, educated people who were very much aligned with Fidel Castro's intentions. You know,
nobody liked Batista.
No one. People were just very, very upset with Batista. And, you know, Fidel Castro, all across the board before his proclamation of the Socialist Republic, enjoyed widespread support among all class groups, except for like the very, very rich and those aligned with the Batista government or U.S. interests, which honestly could be the same thing at that point. But Fidel Castro, incredibly popular until 1961 with all the events that led after that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. In addition to, you know, to publicly supporting communism, this went along with it, increased involvement with the Soviet Union. You know, one thing that happened that year was that Anastas Mikoyan, this long-serving Communist Party chairman, he visits Cuba in 1961, and he sees that the government really is how he imagines a socialist republic to be, and he sees the Cuban Revolution as a genuine communist revolution. And famously, he tearfully remarked that Cuba in the early 60s reminded him of the Soviet Union in the early 20s. It was this like this revolutionary passion of his youth. And really what I want a big chunk of this episode to talk about is the fact that these passions, this image of Cuba, which might not necessarily be the most correct image, were shared all across the Soviet Union by a whole lot of different people. And then as soon as this pivot to Moscow happened, all of these Russian military and economic and scientific advisors were invited to Cuba. And in the Soviet Union, these guys were just, these men and women were just clamoring to go. Everyone wanted to move to Havana.
I mean, listen, have you been to Russia? Do you really want to spend the winter in Moscow?
This is a Soviet-born Cuban film professor. Could you read this quote from Zoya Barash, Jamie? Her thoughts on Cuba?
Absolutely. We were young and Cuba was beautiful. The country was building socialism. We came willingly out of love. We are one with Cuba. It's just like how it was during the Spanish Civil War. Everything sounds romantic with a Spanish accent. Oh man, that's a good one.
There really was kind of a sexualized image here. You know, actually, let's talk about that now, actually. Can you read this interesting Anne Gorsuch quote that we have here?
Anne Gorsuch writes, there was an enthusiasm and romance between Cuban and Soviet citizens, but there was also mistrust. Both desire and anxiety are particularly evident in Soviet discourses and encounters with the gendered and racialized Cuban body, including the virile Cuban man, the consumptive pleasures of sex associated with the Cuban woman, and the impoverished black body believed to be a special need of Soviet assistance.
So you had this national obsession with Cuba in the Soviet Union, but it was still, unfortunately, kind of rooted in stereotypes, in this impression of Cubans as both these uniquely oppressed people and also these unique revolutionary subjects. What I find really interesting is that you had Russian soldiers in the Red Army chanting the Castro slogan, Patria o Muerte, you know, home, motherland or death. And a lot of children named Theodore started insisting in the early 60s that they should actually be called Fidel. I think that there's a couple really interesting cultural artifacts I want to bring up here. This is a figure who is a Soviet poet who has a pretty interesting connection to Cuba that we'll mention. But his name was Yevtushenko, and he was obsessed with the history of the Cuban Revolution, especially a young man named Jose Echevarria.
So from my understanding, prior to talking with you guys, I learned about Jose Echevarria. He was a student, I believe, in the pre-revolution period. His whole fame thing was that they were going to storm the palace and the presidential palace and kill Batista, and then get on the radio and announce his death and kind of have this heroic, romantic uprising of the Cuban people once Batista was dead. Well, didn't turn out quite the way he wanted. He did get on the radio and he spoke a little bit. I believe a chunk of his speech was cut off by some loud noise that was created that prompted the transmitter to just shut off or something like that. You know, he was able to proclaim on the radio that Batista was dead, but after that, the part where he says Cubans rise up and come out into the streets, that part was cut off.
Yeah. Well, why don't you read what the poem has here? This is not necessarily how it happened. This is how the Russian public perceived of this moment.
Right. And so it goes like this. And so, bursting in with the revolver, he ripped the microphone away. Like the voice of Cuba, courage and faith, he began to speak the truth. Just for 3 minutes. Only for 3 minutes. And a gunshot. And nothing is heard. Batista's bullet became a period in his yet unfinished speech. And once more, rock and roll began howling as usual. But he, now invisible, had given his life for 3 minutes of his truth. You remember, Manzana, youth, this is how you must live. Do not idle your time. Go to your death, having forgotten peace and comfort, but speaking at least 3 minutes of truth. Just give me 3 minutes, then let them kill me.
Yeah, and I think it's powerful. But I think it also we should mention that it's not necessarily an accurate picture of what the revolution was like. Like, it's a caricature, and it's one of a lot of Soviet caricatures of Cuba. Possibly the most funny, if we could bring this up now, there was even this radio hit that was all over the Soviet airwaves, which was a song called Cuba My Love, a Russian song, you know, celebrating their imagination of the Cuban Revolution. And I think one thing I want to mention is that in 1963, which was right before this movie gets made, Fidel goes to Moscow. And unlike the Soviet imagination of Stalin receiving cheering crowds in Berlin, Castro did receive a cheering audience in Russia, in Moscow. So there was just this massive, massive interest in the Cuban project coming out of the Russian public. And the Cuban government knew this, and they wanted to tap into this. In the early 1960s, the Cuban government was eager to broadcast the revolution onto the world stage. And, you know, fresh off that Soviet victory at Cannes, with Kolotozov's The Cranes Are Flying, Che Guevara founds the Cuban Institute for Cinematic Arts Industries, which, since 1959, has been the film board of Cuba. You know, they used the sugar profits to buy Japanese equipment and started making their own films. They even actually had this, I don't think they met their goal, but they had this really lofty goal of making 3 movies a month. However, the Cuban government didn't have much money or much homegrown talent at this time. There was only one notable film director in Cuba.
This is Tomás Gutiérrez Alea, who I'm very acquainted with. One of his movies is fantastic, Memories of the Underdevelopment, Memoria de Subdesarrollo, is a fantastic director. He has another movie, I believe, The Death of Bureaucracy or The Bureaucrat. I haven't seen that one, but I've heard great things about
it. I haven't seen that one. It's like a lighthearted lampoon of Cuban bureaucracy.
Well, so Alea is interesting because he wasn't part of this film creatively, but he was essential in getting it made because Alea was insistent that the Cuban Revolution had to be part of this global socialist project, and they had to bring in people from across the world to witness it, both people from the Eastern Bloc, these Soviet filmmakers, and also a lot of Western leftists like Pablo Neruda, Jean-Paul Sartre, and even the French pioneering filmmaker Agnès Varda, who was part of the French New Wave. She and many other filmmakers came to Cuba to these screenings of these early revolutionary movies. And of course, one of the foreign guests was Mikhail Kolotozov, the director of The Cranes Are Flying. And as soon as he visited the island, he was convinced that he had to make a movie about the revolution. So in 1961, just a couple years after the revolution, Kolotozov partners with the Cuban Cinematic Institute to direct Soy Cuba. Kalatoz, I've worked with this Cuban screenwriter, Enrique Pineda Barnett, who I guess you noted just passed away a few months ago.
Yeah, just in January.
Yeah, and he also worked with Sergei Urusevsky, who is this really fabulous cinematographer, who some people might argue was actually really the creative genius behind this one more than Kolotozov, because so much of the story of this movie is the story of its just fabulous cinematography. He had previously worked on The Cranes Are Flying, which, like I mentioned, had a lot of really innovative editing and montage techniques, and he was going to bring even more crazy techniques to this movie. It was this really interesting union of Soviet and Cuban talent, and also of the techniques of these older 1920s era experimental filmmakers like Kolotozov with this newer generation of filmmakers like Tarkovsky, the academy-trained filmmakers really eager to build off of the innovations of the, you know, Italian neorealism and the French New Wave, but also do something new and something uniquely Soviet.
Yep, absolutely. So the Soviet government lent cutting-edge filmmaking equipment to the film, including using submarine periscope equipment to allow them to film underwater. Cuba withdrew its entire army contingent out of the Orient province during the shooting of combat scenes because they were worried that soldiers would mistake what was happening for another Bay of Pigs.
Oh, God.
Young camera operators invented an early version of the Steadicam by hooking a pulley onto a cameraman's shirt and lifting him through a cigar factory. Oh, that's a beautiful scene.
It's really incredible. I believe that the young camera operator in question is Raul Garcia, who is also one of the actors in this movie and is one of the big sources in the documentary The Siberian Mammoth.
Yes, that is correct. Yes, that, I mean, that scene, that for 1964 scene, that it was just beautiful. So that scene starts off at the ground level, right? And it's sort of just, there's this procession going through the streets of, there's a funeral going on pretty much, and it's a very powerful scene. And so the camera starts at the floor, and it just kind of rises above to like the top floor of like this Spanish architectural colonial building in Havana. And as it's going up, there's women on the balcony throwing out flowers, and the camera's so close that it feels like you're right there next to them. And so once it reaches the top, You're thinking, oh, wow, this is where the scene's going to end. You know, they reach the top, and then all of a sudden, the camera starts moving to the right across the street, and it pans into the cigar factory where these men are working, making cigars, and it's so fluid and dynamic.
And then, the men, they stand up from their cigar-making tables, and they wave out the Cuban flag off the balcony.
Yes, beautiful, amazing. For 1964, that's like a drone, that's the drone footage pretty much in nowadays.
So the movie has a very distinct look. Like, it almost seems as if the sky is black.
Oh, right, yeah. Even though it's like a sunny day outside.
Yeah, exactly. They were using this military infrared film that they got on loan from the military to create these stunning shots, which hasn't really been recreated. Liam, have you seen this kind of technique used elsewhere?
Not really, no. I think this is also part of why this movie was, when it was rediscovered, was just so jaw-dropping for so many people. Because a lot of these techniques would still be, you know, pretty innovative if used today.
The camera work for this movie is absolutely great. The other great feat in camera work comes with the opening scene of the movie, where a shot of the place where Christopher Columbus supposedly landed on Cuba, with the narrator narrating this very sad poem about,
yeah, I am Cuba, the Cuba of the casinos, the Cuba of the slums.
Yeah, exactly. And then we transition to La Habana.
This amazing cut, I should add. This amazing cut where it's this incredibly lively party. You've got girls in bikinis. You've got like the 60s version of a wet t-shirt contest going on. You've got this rock and roll band, you know, blaring. And there's the camera. It goes all the way up this building. Then it goes down into the pool where people are swimming and diving. It goes underwater. It uses that Soviet periscope. It's just an incredible sequence. And I think that opening scene is, those opening 2-3 minutes are probably what ensured that this film would eventually become this cinematic masterpiece. Because it's so incredible, especially for something from 64.
It only took like, what, 30 years for it to be appreciated? That's a crazy thing about this movie.
Yeah, and I think also it's probably important to note is that even though this is such an incredibly well-made film with some really good performances too, so many people involved in this film were either first-time filmmakers or amateur actors. Belka, the wife of the cinematographer Uruzevsky, she was the casting director, and she just grabbed Cuban people off the street and asked them, hey, do you want to be in a movie? Like Maria, she's in the first major story. She was just a girl at the market.
Yeah, she was surprised to be casted because, you know, her hair was too greasy and there's no way. Belka, like, are you sure you want me in a movie looking like this? And, you know, got invited to the hotel room where they're all staying. I was like, oh, that's so funny.
Well, I know that one thing that you found interesting, many of these characters, I guess she's the most prominent one, she and her boyfriend are Black. They're Afro-Cubans, which you were surprised to see represented in such prominent roles in this kind of film.
Yeah, especially, I guess we could talk about the scene in the club where Maria is present and they had all the Afro drumming.
Just for some context, yeah, it's these American tourists who are played by French actors doing the worst American accents you've ever heard.
I'll take that tasty morsel.
Yeah, it's great. Like, oh, baby, yeah. These terrible American tourists are leering at these Cuban dancing girls, and a lot of them are wearing these African masks.
Yeah, that scene started with the African man, Afro-Cuban man playing the drum because the Americans were like, oh, cut this sad crap out. We want something. We want a party. We want lively stuff. And so,
yeah, the Americans are not fans of Loco Amor.
Yeah, exactly. They wanted something crazy. So I was surprised to see that the drumming that they included is
one interesting detail that I thought that might just be a total coincidence was that that Loco Amor, which is this kind of like sappy doo-wop song in Spanish, sung by these two Black singers. Those singers, they have on their backs, they have white masks. So these are Black singers with white masks, which I think is kind of interesting. And, you know, of course, that instantly brings to mind, you know, Frantz Fanon, the writer around this time. That might just be a coincidence, his book, Black Skin, White Masks. But also, I thought that use of masks was interesting, because in the very next scene, you have these basically strippers coming out in these, like, you know, caricatures of African masks. But I think what they're trying to show here is that the Americans are enjoying this very, you know, stereotypical, artificial construction of Cuban culture, which is a very understandable critique. But I also think that's kind of interesting because it turns out that a lot of Cubans thought that was what this movie was doing too. They thought that this film Soy Cuba itself was a caricature, and that they felt like almost like they were the butt of a joke.
Yeah, I tried hard to contact family members to see if they knew anything about this movie. You know, a little bit of context, my family, we come from a background of poor farmers in the central province. So we had no ties to any big city, really. So I could see why they did not know the movie, but it's just something that no one knew. I was so surprised. I'm like, not a single person in Miami that I knew of Cuban descent knew about this movie. And I was shocked by that. Honestly, I didn't know that it was such poorly received in Cuba.
Yeah. And it was intended to be this major commercial hit. You know, like the people making this film, Kolotozov, thought it would be this popular celebration of socialism, both in Cuba and in Moscow and even in across the world.
Yeah, I don't know why the Cuban people didn't, you know, you mentioned why, but to me, I guess from my point of view and, you know, with more context nowadays, I guess people just didn't want to see and relive those moments of the Batista government, because even nowadays, you know, my grandparents and stuff like that, no one wants to think about those days. Even if you hate Fidel Castro and you hate the revolution, you hate communism, and, you know, you're a goddamn imperialist, capitalist Cuban living in Miami, no one says, oh, yeah, things are, like, at least a little bit better under Batista. Everyone's like, oh, no, things are bad under Batista. And you know, the people say things are bad under Castro. But no one really talks about Batista as, like, the better alternative. It was just like, There's a mutual understanding there between the Cuban people of why the revolution happened. It happened for a reason, because the the before was just so awful. It was just so horrible that I don't think anybody really wanted to see it, what life was pre-revolution, even in a movie, especially in 1964, when the wounds are still so fresh, when the wounds are still so close to home. No one wants to relive that. That's kind of the interpretation I took as to why it might have had a poor performance in Cuba at the time.
And do you think that in addition to the depictions of all the poverty, which we haven't really talked about, but a lot of this movie is really about, you know, poverty and oppression, do you think that also the scenes of like American tourism and luxury, do you think that the depiction of that excess also kind of bothered people?
Oh, it had to. It had to. There's no way it didn't. I mean, the level of poverty for Cubans was just insane. Like, we only look at this luxurious lifestyle in Havana, but if we were to venture outside of Havana, I think the scene where they show Maria, the neighborhood she lived in, that's what, like, I'd say a good 80% of Cuba looked like. People living in those conditions, in the farming areas, outside of the city center. Most people live like that, especially Afro-Cubans. Afro-Cubans had it the worst, and to be honest, to this day, still have it the worst. To see such luxury in your country for people that are not Cubans, it hurts. Cubans are, from my experience, are very prideful. They're very prideful people. So to see them, to see other people enjoying their island like that, I think it would sting a little bit for sure.
Yeah. So let's talk about these four vignettes that really make up the movie. After this little introductory monologue, they show us four stories, which are pretty interesting.
Yeah, so these are four stories told from four different walks of life in Cuba. The first one tells the story of this secret prostitute, Maria, also known as Betty, and her encounter with an American that destroys her chances for romance with the local fruit vendor, who's also smuggling propaganda.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say that this vignette is the most iconic one of the movie. It just feels very Cuban. It has all of these Afro-Cuban elements, which are normally quite missing.
Yeah.
And this includes the club scene that we've spoken a lot about earlier.
And of course, the Americans. I just can't get enough of them. Like, they're so good.
Well, you listen here, Buster. See?
I mean, the story of Betty is something that kind of was, it had disappeared in Cuba until the special period and the economic downfall that Cuba experienced. The story of the jinetera, you know, that's the word for prostitute that they would use for these. And jinetero, male-oriented, where these Cuban males and women would solicit foreigners for sex work and stuff like that for money. This was something that was gone in Cuba until the 90s, where, and nowadays it's very, very prominent again, the lifestyle of Cuban women and men soliciting foreigners for, you know, just kind of to sponsor their lifestyle. You know, they'll romance a foreigner, and then the foreigner will go back to the country, and, you know, they'll still keep in contact. Like, hey, could you send me some money for this? Could you send me some money for that? Oh, I thought you'd love me. Why aren't you doing this? It's not so much simple as, you know, it's not sex tourism in the case that you come, you have the sex, and you leave. No, you have a Cuban girlfriend now or a Cuban boyfriend, and you got to keep maintaining them. And so, you know, where it was once Americans, now it's like Italians and Spaniards and Canadians. Those are like the three major groups.
So you would say that basically the sex economy of Cuba has just been totally replicated these days.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's been replicated and it's advanced to a new level with modern technology. Obviously, it's become much more advanced back then it was just like in the moment, a one-time thing. Now, some of these women and men in Havana have a steady income from foreigners just, you know, treating them to gifts and give them stuff. And the foreigners come like a few times a year to visit and, you know, spend a lot of money. And it's just kind of made this entire industry of sex work. And it's not really controllable because a lot of it, it's a relationship now. It's not just sex. It's become a relationship where, you know, both partners could feel like they're in love, and, you know, the foreigner just wants the partner to live, you know, in good condition. So it's evolved. It started off as a sex tourism, and some people have found love, or so they say. And, you know, it's become a complicated situation at the very least. But yeah, the Betty story is one that is just super common now in Cuba. It's something that was that had disappeared. It had died off. The Cuban government had created this committee for specifically for women that were in that situation in the Batista times. And in the 90s, I think that the committee was disbanded because of, you know, the economic situation. And so we saw this return back to that. And yeah, Betty's story is just one that's common now, unfortunately.
And what about the second story, the second vignette in this film?
The second story tells the story of a sharecropper. I believe his name is Pedro. And it opens with like this very brief overview of Pedro's life in this very dreamy style. Did you pick up on that, Liam? Like, do you have any idea how they did that?
No, I'm not sure, actually. And they didn't mention much in the documentary about how that was shot.
It's very entrancing. It's sort of like just like it's kind of like looking at a pond. And you have all of these like different waves and reflections slightly distorting.
It's very dreamlike.
So basically the sharecropper learns that his landlord is going to be selling the land to United Fruit Company.
Yeah. And if anyone's read much about Latin American history, oh yeah, United Fruit.
God damn those people. Fuck them. Oh my God. This is the story that hits the home hardest for me, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, I just to interject right now, United Fruit still exists. They are Chiquita Banana.
Love those bananas, all right.
Yeah, so the landlord tells Pedro that he's going to be selling his land to United Fruit. And of course, like, these are sharecroppers. They have nothing to their name except for debts. And so he just sort of goes crazy, gives his kids a little bit of money so they could go to town, drink some Coca-Cola, have some fun, while he sets his field on fire and kills himself.
Watching that whole scene, I was just like, oh wow, this is something like this is what like my grandpa would have like done. So like the whole scene, just from the very start, he loses his wife, I believe. So it's just him and his two kids at a young age. He becomes deeply indebted and stuff like that. And
I'm not sure how exactly the system worked in Cuba. It essentially meant that you were going into every season in debt because you had to go into debt to buy the seeds, to rent the tools, to get food from the landlord. And then when you finally got around to selling season, you almost certainly wouldn't have enough money to actually like pay off the debt that you had accumulated in the first place. And then you have to go and take more debt.
Yeah, the system my grandpa was a part of when he was young, I think it's a tenant farmer where he worked the land of a very wealthy landowner. He kind of worked as a farmer cultivating lands for a much wealthier person. And so the landlord would give some of these farmers a very small plot of land on the farm for personal cultivation. But the majority of the work was working the crops for the landlord for a certain like amount of money or something like that. But then on my grandpa left that field of work, and in the revolution, he decided he cut a lot of sugarcane for the revolution, a lot of sugarcane. I think working for the government at that point, obviously. But something that I liked about something that he said while when he was old and he was giving his little monologue, it was like, life was so miserable for Pedro that he said the worst thing in life is not death, but life itself. And I'm just like, that's something so like, to me, it's cheesy and corny because it's something my grandpa has said before when I've like talked about him. Because like, it's just being a farmer, being a sugarcane like farmer is such a miserable job. It is just the hardest work out there, especially under the Cuban sun. It is just awful. So I can really understand why he would say that, especially with the death of his wife at a young age with his two kids. And, you know, his land is not really his land. And he's just, it's such a shitty life situation. Awful, awful life situation. And I thought he was, when he gave his kids that dollar to go spend at the store, I thought, oh my God, he's going to go hang himself and just kill himself. Because that's something that it's like a very common reaction, unfortunately, in like farming communities that I've heard. When there's like no way out, like men will just go on and just kill themselves. Like, no, they won't think about it. They'll hang themselves from like the trees on the farm. And that's the way to take care of business when there's no way out, there's no possible solution. You just hang yourself and you get it over with. You save everybody the misery. You preserve your honor. You go out like a man. You take it into your own hands and you take care of the situation. That's the last time you have control over something in your life because you've never had control over anything, not your farm, not your land, not your money, nothing. There's nothing you're in control except the dignity of taking your own life. That's something that is common. I've in my time going to Cuba, that I've talked to a lot of these Cuban men. It's just like, that's the way to do it. That's just how it is. And it's so insane.
In this kind of this honor suicide tradition, do you think that continues, you think, after the revolution into modern Cuba?
Oh, yeah. I was in Cuba in October of 2019. I went to Cuba to visit my grandpa to celebrate his 82nd birthday, I believe. And while I was there, he was sitting on the balcony and he was telling me about the day before I got there, this guy had hung himself on a tree behind the apartment because he was I think he had some sort of problem and he couldn't take care of it because he didn't have enough money to take care of it. And so, you know, that was the end of that. He's like, oh, I'm indebted in a black market to somebody or something. And I know I'm never going to be able to pay for it because I don't have any family in America to send me money. And no one has this level of money to lend me. I'm going to go out and hang myself from the tree. And I was just like, oh my God, this is awful. My grandpa's just telling a story. And he's like, oh yeah. He's just laughing about it. He's like, oh yeah, what are you going to do? That's what you got to do. I was like, what do you mean? That's what you have to do. You have to hang yourself? It was such a, he just laughed it off. Yeah, this is what men do. This is how you take care of business. If you can't take care of business normally, it's a very rural, old timey way of thinking that has still survived a little bit in these farming communities in Cuba, I believe.
And also that makes me think that maybe that, so a lot of aspects of this film, even if they were distortions of the reality of Cuba before the revolution, some of these depictions were accurate.
I would say so. Yeah. There's a lot of it's always the small things in the film that you just kind of see. And as a Cuban and someone who's interested in Cuba's history, I just see and I'm like, oh yeah, that definitely happened. That was something real. Maybe it might be exaggerated to a point, to a dramatic point, but it's something, I think there's a lot of truth in this film. There's a lot of moments where it shows life as it really was in Cuba before the revolution, for sure.
I think probably part of what you mentioned, which is why it taps into this, genuine cultural tradition of suicides, is that the screenwriter, Enrique Pineda Barnett, was this prominent Cuban, young Cuban writer. And, speaking of the name Enrique, the third story, which I think is my personal favorite, is the student story, which is it takes us out of the countryside and back into Havana. And it's about a young man named Enrique who is involved in this kind of very, I guess you'd say, kind of an impotent student group that resists the Batista government, but not as strongly as he wishes to. And he takes them in a more revolutionary direction. And he gets this goal to kill the chief of the Havana police, but he's unable to do it. He sees the man's children and he holds back.
We should note that this movie engages in quite a bit of fat shaming in this sequence.
The William Howard Taft-shaped police captain.
They captured him perfectly, man. Oh my God. He even had the gold, Cuban link bracelet that, my dad and uncle have nowadays. He had it all. He had the cigar.
You know, they showed the guy's kids. Those guys' children today, every single one of them owns a restaurant or a cigar shop in Miami.
That guy, that chief of police, looks like every Cuban male in Miami. No exaggeration. That is peak Cuban American performance from that guy.
That's just what every Cuban man begins to look like when he hits 50.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it, honestly. It's just kind of replicate the Cuban pride is to just get super fat and just have a lot of gold chains. Oh man, it's gonna be a great time.
It's a very respectable style.
What happens after Enrique is unable to kill this large gentleman?
So Enrique is unable to actually carry out the deed because he sees this man eating breakfast with his wife and children, and he just couldn't bring himself to do it. But then he goes back to his comrades at the university to inform them about what had happened. And there's this massive protest going on because news had reached the people of Havana that Fidel is not dead, that him and his fighters are still out in the Orientes. And at that point, just shifts to Enrique giving a speech. The police try to disperse this demonstration with fire hoses, but the students are persistent. They continue to march forward, and ultimately the sequence ends with the tragic death of Enrique, who has now become a martyr for the revolution.
Yeah. And this is where that incredible shot that we mentioned, the longest shot in the movie, I believe, the one that goes through the cigar shop. It's a feat of filmmaking. There's one final vignette, you know, kind of brings us back to the countryside that furthers this revolutionary cause that Enrique is part of.
So yeah, the fourth and final story that it shows, it's, you know, the simple farmer and his family in the countryside, just, you know, making their own living off the land, has his wife, has his kids, and he's visited by someone. Someone comes in, you know, they give him a plate of food, and this certain someone just kind of tries to encourage Mariano to join up and fight with the rebels against, you know, Batista and his tyranny and all that. But Mariano, as, you know, probably every normal peasant farmer in Cuba, is like, no, I don't want to risk my family's safety. I want to ensure that, you know, they're safe and sound. I just want to work and keep providing for my family. And, you know, that's understandable. So the gentleman leaves. And then as soon as he leaves, just immediately, Batista's bombing just all around the farm, you know, in an effort to bomb the guerrilla fighters. And I believe his wife and one of his kids gets killed in this bombing. So it's just him and one of his infant toddlers, just kind of this scene where he's just kind of walking around with his toddler who's naked, and just kind of a really sad scene until the point where I think he meets back up with the guerrilla fighters, and he's just like, well, give me a goddamn gun again. I'm ready to fight. And it's just like, well, we don't have a gun. You got to get it like every one of us has. Go out there and get one yourself. And they give him a machete. And, you know, this is where it turns a little action film propaganda kind of movie, just to give it a little bit of that flair.
This is where they had to take away the soldiers out of the Oriente province because they didn't want them thinking a real rebellion was happening.
That is insane. Yeah, I got to take out the army contingent.
Well, one thing I should mention, this was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So they were taking these soldiers out of the eastern province when you could argue that was a time when you might have really needed soldiers to be there defending the country. So it's really funny that the Cuban government was so collaborative.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, so that's the movie.
And of course, all of these vignettes are punctuated by the continuation of that poem.
That basically kind of sums up, you know, the screenwriter's vision of the long view of human history. But, you know, this film, even though the Cuban government was so involved in the production, when the film finally came out, the reaction from the Cuban government was somewhat chilly.
Despite its extravagant visuals, the film was poorly received by both Cuban and Soviet contemporary audiences. In Cuba, the film was dubbed a quote-unquote Soviet hallucination and quote-unquote a delirium for the camera. A major review of the film ran under the headline, "I am not Cuba." Although the film was not officially banned in the Soviet Union, it ran very briefly there and did not receive wide distribution. However, in Soviet film circles, I Am Cuba was an instant sensation, inspiring vigorous debate among viewers and awe by more artistically minded critics. While some criticized the film for its Baroque tendencies to overwhelm narrative content with visuals, others praised it for its artistic mastery and cinematographic innovation.
Yeah, so from the beginning, there were some people who were really interested in Soy Cuba, but it didn't have the kind of, you know, world-shattering implications that these filmmakers thought it was going to have. An example of No Soy Cuba, which is actually from this very well-known magazine that you mentioned, Bohemia, by L.M. Lopez.
Yeah, Bohemia was a magazine, I think, in the early 1900s. It got its start in Cuba, and they kind of reported on various different like topics of history and even fashion at some point. And I had heard about Bohemia from my parents before. It was just a popular magazine across Cuba before and after the revolution, I think. So No Soy Cuba, L.M. Lopez, Bohemia. With the indigenous title Soy Cuba, the Russian filmmakers have released their first film shot among us. And frankly, we hope that the recipe will not be repeated, at least with such a formula. Because this work, from which we expected something, has turned out to be a total disappointment, a resounding artistic failure in the midst of a tremendous and hallucinating formalism, captured by Uruzevsky's camera with a wide-angle lens and infrared negative.
No, I'm surprised that like he didn't like the infrared negative stuff. Is what's so cool about this, especially at the beginning. I'm really surprised that he was like, you know, put off by that. I guess, you know, because this is a film critic, you think he'd know better.
Soy Cuba begins with melancholic palm trees where Columbus is presumed to have disembarked. The Indians paddle carrying loads on their head, showing their skin burnt by the tropical sun, and only the Guajiro point is missing. But instead, we are grateful for the sober voice of Raquel Revuelta, obliged to read a cursed text that indexes in sugar and pain and sweat and other topics that allow a direct cut to be to that condemned, indifferent, selfish city, that new Gomorrah of the Caribbean, which forgets its children of the countryside and is distracted and amused to that cursed Havana that organizes beauty contests in big hotels, while there are still destitute neighborhoods inhabited by mulatta chorus girls in love with friendly black criers who hand out clandestine propaganda.
I think it's funny that he points out the cut, you know, from like the country, the idyllic countryside at the time of the first Colombian contact to the Havana casino, because that's one of the things that people talk about the most. Both Soviet critics and American critics, they adored that juxtaposition. But here, this guy finds it cheesy.
Yeah, I imagine that you might find it cheesy if you're a Cuban that lives or knows the situation with Cuba at the time. So I can understand that a little bit more than from a insider perspective, let's say. Here ends the intention of screenwriters and directors, and another story begins. That of cinematographer Udevsky, with that insufferable camera and his false audacity, blaming Yankee tourists for the problems of our own social frustration. In the past, the problems of our capital hypertrophy and the development of our bourgeoisie turned to real estate investments. The representation is false. The sappy personal drama of the mulatta chorus girl is false. And is also false, the obliged relation of luxury environment to the poverty environment, made in an absurd way with total violation of any logical principle, even within the greatest thematic freedom.
Man, he's just too mad. Like, I don't like this. Like, I normally like haters, but I just, like, this one cuts deep.
Yeah, I think it goes beyond what a film critic should be criticizing in a film. I would like to know what personal ties he has to, well, Cuba and or the movie or the people working in the movie.
Maria didn't want to date him.
That has to be it. That has to be it.
The critics in Cuba didn't understand it. They said the cameraman danced around so much it felt like a circus, and that Cubans didn't want to see a movie about life in the old Cuba. It wasn't popular with common spectators, so they pulled it after 1 week. In Moscow, it was unpopular for a different reason. They thought it glorified American life in Cuba, so the Russians didn't understand it either. And focusing on the second part a little bit, this goes back to what we talked about all the way back in our first episode where we talked about Lietov and Гражданская оборона. Like, this is basically the same phenomenon of, like, these sort of midwit bureaucrats working at the censorship desk going purely off vibes, deciding that, like, they don't like this or that. And so, like, these complete numbnuts, they saw the opening sequence that shows this extravagant life of tourists, and they just take it at face value, and they just say, this looks good, this looks appealing, this is going to make people want to go to America and live under capitalism. And it's like, me watching this movie, I'm seeing it go from the poverty of the countryside straight into this extravagant lifestyle for white American tourists. It just speaks to the injustice of the issue in the first place. It just shows the fact that capitalism is predicated upon leaving the vast majority of the population immiserated so that a select few could enjoy the good life.
And something that I also find quite interesting is that, you know, the film is describing and depicting the inequalities of pre-revolutionary Cuba, but in the process, in a strange kind of way, it almost seemed to replicate that inequality. Because suddenly, you have all of these foreigners who are from a society that's I would say, substantially wealthier than Cuba, from the Soviet Union, who are coming in here, filming this project, and then leaving in a way that I guess reminded many people of the Yankees. Jamie, would you mind reading this bit, which is by Evtushenko, the poet from earlier, the poet who wrote that piece about Echeverria? He was one of the screenwriters alongside Enrique Pineda Barnett.
But what happened to Udrzewski and Kalatozov in the city? It was already a different situation in Cuba. I took them out, telling them about the beauty of the Cuban market. Havana had an amazing tiered market. And at that time, Fidel banned private trade, fighting speculation. They said it was a Russian's idea, but I saw it with my own eyes. Khrushchev ciphered, begging Fidel not to do it, not to ban private trade. It's amazing. It was almost forbidden. But Khrushchev was a farmer, and with his life experience, he told Fidel, don't do it, or else you will have to organize an NEP like we did. And he was right.
Yeah, the new economic policy. If anyone's not familiar, the NEP or the NEP was this very interesting policy in the 20s. In the Soviet Union, after the revolution, they brought back capitalist market forces because they realized that after the Civil War, they were so drained of resources that the government was unable to meet the needs of citizens, so they temporarily resumed market transitions.
Fidel had banned private trade before we could buy groceries. We arrived at the market where everything was gone. The chemical juice was all that was left. We came to the citrus groves where there were piles of mandarins, grapefruits, and oranges lying around that no one was cleaning up. They were rotting there. In Cuba, the fruit had disappeared. Can you imagine that? And when Kolotozov arrived at the market, I didn't know the results yet. It was the first day of the ban. There was nothing to shoot. You couldn't have the whole multi-level landscape of that market covered with muzzles. And we walked. It was completely empty. The wind was whistling and some small kiosks were standing. There were lines of women and there was nothing but Bulgarian cucumbers, mitschi vinegar, I'm going to butcher that one, and I think Czech ham, which was so strictly rationed. Kolotozov and Uruzevsky saw this after they had waited so long for this trip and arrived with such a rosy mood. And then the women started shouting, Russos, go home. And they used to yell, Yankees, go home. Imagine what happened to Mikhail Konstantinovich when he heard this. His tears welled up. He asked, why? I didn't leave his side the whole time. And I told him, forgive them, Mikhail. They are good people, but it's hard for them. A historic mistake has been made. We made such mistakes too.
And I think this little anecdote kind of contextualizes the negative feelings that a lot of Cubans had about this film. In addition to bringing up these awful memories of just a few years prior, I think that they kind of thought that, like, you know, if they were dissatisfied with these economic policies of the mid-60s, they might have thought that, you know, it was kind of happening again. They are poor, whereas the Soviets, who they blame for their plight, get to basically enjoy their country from afar.
Well, the Cubans just have to wait a little bit longer so they can get that canned Russian meat and it would all be good, baby. Oof, that thing was delicious.
Everybody loves tushonka.
I wish I had, but my family members talk about it like it was the hottest stuff on the market, man. They love that Russian canned meat. I mean, yeah, when they were...
It was like Spam? Like Russian, like Spam, but Russian?
I think so, yeah. I think it was that kind of texture, that kind of thing, but... I just know that my family, they talked about like that was some good stuff.
Was this during the special period or before?
No, this is before. So my parents were kids in the 80s.
Well, speaking of your parents' stories, you said that your family had not heard of this movie Soy Kuba, right?
Oh no, not at all. Nobody I had spoken to had heard about this movie. Like I think I said, my mom knew about the death of a bureaucrat, that movie by Alea, but not this one. This was really a hard movie to find.
Well, Sam, what did the lead actor Sergio Coeri say about this?
After the movie came out, it was put aside, not only in Cuba, but I think everywhere. The movie was unknown, even to Cubans. When you mention Soy Cuba today, people don't know what it is, and people still don't know what it is.
Yeah, and it's like, it's kind of sad because, you know, Kolotozov, it really seems like he had hoped to ignite this worldwide revolutionary spirit with this movie, but it didn't land in Cuba, and it didn't seem to really land in the Soviet Union either. It was popular among film nerds in the USSR, but it wasn't widely available. And Kolotozov only produced one more film after this, which was The Red Tent, which is also a joint production, this time with Italy. But then he died. And then Uruzevsky, the cinematographer, died quite soon after as well. So the film really kind of went dormant. It's a great movie, but for 30 years, nobody watched it and nobody knew about it.
It only took the collapse of the Soviet Union for it to be found again. That's a hell of a history.
Yeah. You could argue that just like how in the 60s, the Cuban Revolution, you know, sparked something among so many Russians, in the 90s, something in Russia, a really rough place, you know, it kind of sparked something in Cuban people. Because in the early 90s, this film was miraculously rediscovered, you know. I'm sure, you know, as they were privatizing all of the assets of the Soviet state, you know, people were, you know, tearing apart all these old archives and seeing what they could sell. Somebody found a copy of this film at the bottom of a drawer. What did Enrique Pineda Barnett say? What did he say when he learned that this movie was discovered?
I couldn't believe it. It's like he told me a relative I thought was dead was actually alive. It was a mammoth had been found perfectly preserved in the Siberian ice.
Soy Cuba, the Siberian mammoth, you know? And then the kind of happy ending here is that as time goes on, it's the film has this really big second life. It was screened at the Telluride Film Festival in 92. And then in 95, Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola teamed up to distribute it basically worldwide on home video. Scorsese actually met Calzati, one of the cinematographers before, or the camera operator rather. And what Scorsese supposedly told him was, if I had seen this movie when I was young, I would be a completely different director today.
That's insane to me. That's a powerful, powerful thing to say. Wow.
And what's amazing is that so many of these Cuban filmmakers who were part of the movie didn't even know it was discovered at that time as a consequence of the embargo in the special period. They had much bigger things to worry about. But then when the documentary, The Siberian Mammoth, was produced, they went back to Cuba and they showed the people involved. They went to the actors. Like you mentioned, you know, that story about the actress who played Maria worrying about her greasy hair. She mentions that in this documentary. Although I think it's important to mention, though, that not everyone was so happy that it was recovered. Or at the very least, not everyone was so happy that it was so celebrated upon its release. Can you read this quote, Sam, from Carlos Fariñas, the composer?
I don't understand how a work that was so despised at the time is now considered a classic of world cinema. For years, the so-called Western world ignored us, criticized the socialist realist style as academic or brutal. But now, one American critic praises socialist realism. The greatest works of socialist realism are brought to American museums after communism, because communism is no longer a threat. This has to do with the dialectics of class interest. There's an interest in Russian art, unknown and hidden from the capitalist world.
Yeah, so is it just more fetishization? Is it the same as, like, you know, what bothered the Cuban audiences in the 60s? What do you guys think?
Not quite. He's just mad that he didn't get the credit when he was young and he could have made a name for himself, I think.
I mean, like, I understand where he's coming from. I see what he says, but I the Cuban in me just tells me that this is just a Cuban bitter man that didn't get you know, the recognition or something like the rise to fame that, you know, they thought that this movie was gonna, you know, bring about. But I do think that at that point about, you know, the greatest works of socialist realism are brought to American museums after communism, after it's no longer a threat. I mean, like, would an American critic bring it to America during the Soviet Union when it was around? Would it receive such praise from American film critics during the power of the Soviet Union? I don't think so. I don't think it'd be, you know, it's something like, if it did, you know, Martin Scorsese he'd probably get a knock on his door from the government and be like, hey buddy, what are you doing with this film here? Hey, you gotta stop that. That's not right.
Yeah, and especially because, you know, like people like Jane Seberg, you know, a lot of filmmakers who had any association with socialist causes in this era, they did get knocks like that. They were hounded horribly by American intelligence.
Oh, I bet. You know, you got to fight that culture war, man.
Yeah, like, I think the blacklists were still in place when filming was taking place for Soy Cuba.
That's true. They might have been 64. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's just such an interesting project, and it gives you so much to think about in terms of what this movie says about Cuba, but also really what it says about the ways that Russians perceive Cuba. You know, it's like there's such a strong cultural influence, goes in both directions. Like, we mentioned how little boys in Russia at one point started calling themselves Fidel, but of course, you know, Jamie, you know all about this. A lot of women, especially in Cuba to this day, have Russian-derived names.
Yes, there's the whole Y generation, which is like that's my mom's a part of that generation.
Why is it called the Y generation?
Because all these names, the Y generation, you started with the name Y. You could have a normal name, but you know, instead of having a J, you know, Jessica would be Jessica with a Y to make it sound more Soviet-like, or just really ridiculous stuff. You know, I've heard for even for men, you know, instead of Jordan, you have Jordani with a Y. it's just like all across the board, you know, that was a fad, you know. So you have a lot of these like 30 to 50 year old Cuban men and women with these Y like names.
No, I think it's kind of funny that Generation Y in Cuba overlaps almost exactly with Generation X in the US.
Yes, exactly.
Well, yeah, well, that's why I think this movie is such a cool project, because it shows these links that a lot of Americans would otherwise have no understanding of. And on top of that, it's just a really good movie. It's just so well done. And what's also so interesting is that it's so groundbreaking, yet it was denied any influence because it was hidden away. It was unable to influence a generation of American filmmakers that maybe it has since. But you kind of wonder if this film had been more widely shown, maybe American films would have looked a little bit different.
After watching it, I think it's such a shame that this movie was so covered up, or it didn't reach the audience that it intended to, or just the reception it received. It's a shame, because I just think the story is, you know, it's whatever, like we discussed, but the way the movie was shot just made it so much more interesting and made it so much more worthwhile. It was such a fantastic project, and for it to have disappeared for 30 plus years and then get rediscovered at the bottom of a drawer, it's such a sad tale. It really is. And it's a tragedy almost.
Well, it could be a glass half full type situation where finally these people are getting the recognition they deserve, and finally this amazing film is recognized for, you know, the innovation that it actually brought to the field.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, it's sad that that Kolontozov and Uruzeski, and also, you know, Uruzeski's wife Belka, who they had all passed away by the time this film was rediscovered. But most people, especially on the Cuban side who were involved in the film, they were still around, you know. And then Ed Calzadi, who we mentioned before, he ended up returning to Cuba and reuniting with a lot of the people he'd worked with.
Yeah, better late than never, that's for sure, when it comes to this film. I had never heard of this film until recently. I had heard of, you know, The Death of a Bureaucrat and Memories of the Underdevelopment, which I absolutely loved. But this is one that I had escaped me, you know, never really heard about it until now. And, you know, I'm glad I did. I think it shows a lot about, you know, Cuban cinematography in its infancy, with the first years of the Icaic and all that stuff. It's nice. It's nice to see something like this was produced.
I was wondering, Jamie, if you might want to close us off with this episode with this quote here by Raul Garcia, who was, you know, the camera operator who might have been the one who got lifted up through the cigar shop. It's hard to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So Raul Garcia says, "The efforts made by that group of Russian Soviet intellectuals were to get closer to Cuba and to discover with a loving vision the Cuban reality. If they understood us or not, it doesn't matter. All I know is that at that time, they were trying to support us. For American people to discover it so many years later is really delightful and surprising."
So Raul Garcia is saying that Americans should enjoy things. I'm going to be bold here and say that they don't. We don't. We do not deserve this movie. Like, Scorsese saved this movie, and now we live in Marvel hell despite his efforts. So, I mean, was it all for naught, maybe?
God bless the MCU. The most American film.
It's a great movie. And if you haven't seen Soy Cuba yet, please watch it. It's available somewhere if you look deep enough.
It's available on YouTube, actually, if you set your VPN to Europe. But otherwise, you're going to have to resort to less legal means.
Yeah, well, hey, it's piracy is a proud Caribbean tradition. That's all I'll say. All right, well, this has really been a great one. Thank you so much, Jamie, for joining us. And thank you so much for Sam for these incredible translations that you've done. And I think that it's a great movie, and I love talking about it. So, Gladio for Euro, signing off.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.